erecting a true one in its stead. Therefore, there is no problem of frustration. Many religious groups and individuals start their inner lives by leaving the world behind. But it only ends up in one thing. The world leaves them behind. Fulfillment means that every duty, every reasonable problem, must be faced and met. No one can run away from responsibility and substitute meditation for daily labor. It must be a problem of proper fulfillment of each step of the way. Until we take care of the small things that are with us always, we will not be given care over the greater things. Unless we meet the responsibilities of this world, we will not have high estate in the one beyond. So always remember, do not run away from trouble. Do not attempt to get away from this awful, terrible, pernicious environment in which we are all involved and for which, to a degree, we are all responsible. Therefore, to get peace by simply escaping physical problems is a complete delusion. Peace is not settled or centered in physical things. Peace is inside yourself. And until you find it there, you can never get rid of discord. There's only one way. It's all right if the individual wishes on occasion to do a retreat for spiritual nutrition, to get away from a complication for a week or 2 weeks or something of that nature, but not as a major change in life. There are things you can do, however. You may find it possible to find another busy group of people who are doing the things that we all should do, and you can join with them in doing these things. But to try to get away from trouble simply by walking out on it is a common mistake that we should all avoid in every way possible. Also, when you get to work along with this type of thing, we try to find out a little more about the attitude of the mind in problems of meditation. How are we going to approach it? I suppose the simplest approach to it is the gradual refinement of the principle of prayer. Prayer, however, is a constant demand. Prayer is the individual requiring something. It is the individual asking the divine power to fulfill his own personal needs or to place himself at the mercy of the Lord in problems he should be taking care of with his own personal resources. Therefore, the old idea that prayer should only be a request or a demand, or that it is perfectly right and proper to ask anything you want to in a universe of infinite potential, these ideas belong to a rather uncontrolled mental approach to life. Actually, prayer should be, as it was in ancient times, a hymn of gratitude. If we must have an attitude towards the universe in which we exist, it should be an attitude of gratitude. The only reason it's not what it ought to be is our own action. We have been given everything necessary, every resource. We have been given faculties to meet almost any conceivable circumstance with which we can become involved. We should be grateful for the privilege of growing. We should be grateful for the privilege of sharing. We should be very much more happy when we give something than when we gain it. We should recognize ourselves as citizens in what Buddha called the great community, the great universal mystery of life, that we are magnificent creatures, incredibly skilled, that we are here for something much more important than to go out and get killed in an auto accident. We are also here to realize that to have may be necessary to a degree, but that overpossession defeats the very reason for our existence. We should live simply, quietly, and moderately. And by gradually moderating the excesses of our own appetites, we come nearer and nearer to the great quietude of true Zen, or true meditational discipline. It is not an asking, it is a recognizing of all the things for which we should be grateful. It is an opportunity for us to express mentally or even physically our tremendous respect for the great plan of which we are a part, and a rededication of ourselves to the service of that plan. And the search for knowledge should be gathered on the same basis. We should not use the mind to accumulate only that which cannot survive the grave. We should not use the mind constantly and only for temporal things or for personal pleasures. We can have the pleasures, but we should understand them. We should realize that a true pleasure is an experience of reality, that in some gentle way we have found the truth of a thing. But where a pleasure is an extravagant intemperance, it has no relationship whatever to the growing of the person. So all the way along we have the constant problem of fitting ourselves into an attitude of realization in which pessimism, as we know it, is practically impossible. How can we be pessimistic in a universe of eternal benevolence? How can we doubt the legality of a creation in which even the smallest fragment is a magnificent masterpiece of lawfulness? How can we doubt the realities? Maybe the mind can help us to see some of them, and in that way it contributes to our improvement. When we become increasingly conscious of the wonders of existence, our faith grows equivalently. And yet I know people who have watched many wonderful films dealing with nature and nature studies, and at the end of the experience, they have nothing. They wonder a little at the fact some of these creatures are quite unusual, and that's the end of it. There is no recognition of the majesty of these forms of life. There is no realization that there's only one answer, and that is an infinite life, an infinite wisdom, and an infinite love ruling all things. And meditation should be a quiet restatement of these values in ourselves. It should be a process by which we correct any fear that might have arisen in the mind, that constantly meditation is putting us back in order. It is giving us again the full use of the power of discrimination. Meditation actually must be accompanied by wonder, by awe, by the incredible recognition of our environment. They say that one of the first emotions of small children is wonder. They open their eyes to an unbelievable state of things. The very wise person, dedicated to the highest achievements of faith, opens his inner eyes to a universe of infinite wonder. A universe in which all good things are possible, and where ignorance alone stands between the individual and the enrichment of his own life. Now, some might say that perhaps the universe should never have bestowed upon man faculties that he could have used. Yes, but then there is something else to be said. Somewhere in the infinite future of things, each individual is building for a responsibility. He is growing up to something. Here in this world, the person may grow up to be a parent, a mother, or a father. But somewhere in space, we are also growing up in responsibility. Somewhere along the line, we also have a job to do, a destiny to meet. We have a great labor to perform for the cosmic good of which we are a part. And nature makes sure in her own way that before we are given more authority, we will learn to use what we have wisely. The ambitious individual, by the perversion of his authority, comes back perhaps in a very humble estate because he has misused his privileges. The individual, before he can be trusted to go on to something better, must prove conclusively that he has the courage, the discrimination, and the dedication to live every day according to the light of truth. So the testing is like the initiation rituals of antiquity. When a young person in those days wanted to devote his life to the service of the gods or the deity of his community, he was first properly tested. He had to have certain basic knowledge. He had to have three arts or sciences at his control, preferably mathematics, music, and astronomy. These were the indispensables, and he was told when he studied them that he need not expect to make a nickel out of any of them. He might become a teacher, but if so, he would remain comparatively poor. What was necessary was that he should inwardly develop a discrimination, open a window or a door in himself so that something larger could be seen. Mathematics is revealed everywhere. Once you learn the principles, you can see these principles working in every flower, every bird's wing, every crystal in the rock, everything. Mathematics is the open sesame to the laws of existence. Astronomy is the open door to the cosmos, the tremendous immensity of worlds and suns and stars, all of which bear witness to a sovereign intelligence, a divine reality, an infinite power which transcends all our understanding or our awareness. This is the power that ultimately, as we begin to understand a little more about it, brings us down on our knees in veneration for the plan which has made possible our own existence. And the third part was the music. The beauties, the harmony, the wonders, the joys of the arts, the constant recognition that all of the creative arts are in turn laws working, that the laws of existence are most clearly indicated and most easily studied in mathematics, astronomy, and music. So when the young disciple reaches a point where he begins to look at things and looks into them at the same time, so that nothing whatever is meaningless any longer. There is no such a thing as a meaningless thing. If it is truly meaningless, it is a chimera or an illusion. It is not a thing. So from this point on, the student began to develop his integrities. He began to recognize his devotions and his dedications. And in due time, he was permitted to enter into the sanctuary and take his first initiatory rites. Here were the rites of purification, which must precede the meditative disciplines. The great baptismal rites of antiquity were the purification of the heart, mind, and the career, whatever it was, and their rededication to the principles of universal integrity. If the disciple was successful in passing this test, then he went through a discipleship. And finally, if he was able to pass successfully the tests along the way, which included physical problems, he had to show physical courage, control of pain, control of all impulses and appetites, control of his own thoughts and emotions. He had to prove that he was the master of his own soul. If he made this achievement and was given the full grade of initiation, then he took the obligation to use all that he had learned and every skill of his life and every value that he possessed in the service of the common good. Now, these types of dedications are not possible unless the individual has experienced something inside himself. It is very difficult for a Westerner today to think in terms of devoting or dedicating his skills only to the service of others. And yet, actually, that is their only value. But he has now commercialized all these things and made them increasingly difficult to share the problems of life. So we come into the meditational discipline, and we then say to ourselves, how are we going to fit this in? How are we going to live this way in the kind of world we live in now? Well, many people have come to me. We've had a lot of talks on these problems, and folks have brought me all kinds of difficulties which they have faced. But looking them all over, I guess there have been hundreds of them, certain things soon become obvious. The average person is never placed in a situation which is beyond his control. He may not control it, but he is never requested or required to do something that is beyond his capacity or his understanding. He is never supposed to do more than live up to the best he knows. And if he lives up to the best he knows, problems have a strange way of curing themselves. Because the moment you take away from a problem all of your own mental, emotional involvement, the moment you stop being sorry for yourself, the moment you accept the rights of others to exist, and to appreciate their ways of life, when you stop doing things you shouldn't do, the problems get less and less. And this does not mean that you have to live under a different political administration. It doesn't mean that you have to change your religion. It doesn't mean that you have to give up your job. All that it really means is that you come a little nearer to the proper use of your faculties. You do not have to stop work. What's probably the most important is to learn to work, because the average individual spends most of his time trying to figure how to get out of his work. But actually, he's not bringing him very much pleasure because he grudges every moment he spends there. But when his work is a dedication to meeting his share in the great cosmic plan of things, then work is fulfillment. If it is a domestic situation, which many of these situations are, then we find human selfishness, human attitudes, mistakes that individuals refuse to accept, and finally maybe the breaking up of a home that could have been saved if even one of the persons had really worked consciously and conscientiously to protect the situation. The same with children. Very hard these days to control the habits of young people. But it is gradually improving. And when the individual, like the Hindu, realizes that he must pay his own debt to life by giving his own children as much care and attention as they need, regardless of whether he enjoys it or not, he will find that if he brings them up properly, they will be less and less problem. And if the problems do arise, the child will be able to face them through its own experiences. Little by little, things can be brought into order if the person carries his full share of responsibilities and admits his own full share in the troubles with which he is surrounded. So there is really no great problem in trying to live a little better. It may be that some of the ultimates will be a little difficult, but then we are not faced with ultimates at the moment. Each person who makes one straight step forward in the course of his lifetime has fulfilled the purpose of his existence. The main thing is that he shall leave here a little bit better than he was when he got here. He must be enough better to have values, understanding, insights, and realizations that are more than he brought with him. He is not expected to be perfect, but he is expected gradually to recognize the importance of the inner life over the outer situations. Now, if he's doing what he should be doing, presumably, he will find also that when he settles down somewhere for a little quiet heart-to-heart talk with himself, that he finds that he's pretty good company. He will find that he is someone who is easy to get along with, who does have dreams and hopes and aspirations. And he also begins to think in terms of the beauties of life, the beauties of existence, and his own share in them. Things are no longer unimportant because they are small, nor are they important because they have heavy debt attached to them. The individual gradually gets to the point where, when he kind of quiets himself down, things begin to look beautiful to him. He finds the inside of life very peaceful, because the only reason it isn't peaceful is the outside of his own life. And when he begins to work toward that, he gradually achieves what you might term an almost permanent meditational state. As Swami Vivekananda observed on one occasion, namely that the esoteric moods, the disciplines, the meditations, are essentially the continuing realization of the divine plan. Once the person is able to think in these terms, and little problems rise that hurt him, he finds solutions to them. He carries no bitterness. He is not disillusioned, because to be disillusioned means to give up an illusion, not a reality. He is no longer constantly nagged by ambitions that are unfulfilled or responsibilities that have been avoided. He hasn't left anything unfulfilled, and he hasn't avoided anything. And as a result of that, as the Chinese said, in ancient times, men slept without dreams. Dreams are, to the most part, anxieties which we face. Anxieties due to the things we didn't do that we should have done, or that we did do which we shouldn't have done. And as soon as this situation begins to clarify a little bit and relax itself, the individual finds that he can sleep the sleep of the just, and that all will go well. And that in the daylight and daytime, the peace of sleep will continue with him. He will be sleep awake. His life awake will be also gentle and peaceful and productive. There is so much in us that we never do anything with. And meditation is really a process of gradually coming into an intimate, constructive realization of our own natures. Meditation is the individual living continually in the light of inner courage, understanding, and peace. You find people trying to run away from themselves a great deal in our modern world. They want to escape boredom. So the individual does all kinds of things, and some of the things he does are not reprehensible or anything. They're the things that meaning something at the moment. So he just spends one evening a week playing bridge, and spends another day a week watching the football and baseball games. And he does this, he has all his friends in, he has very convivial times. He's always up to something. But with it all, what is he doing? Virtually nothing. He's trying to run away from himself. He's trying not to be bored. Here he has only a few years of life here in which to do all kinds of wonderful things. So he sits around watching lousy programs on television, trying to get rid of the burden of existence. He just wants to get his mind off of himself. And now, when you do that, you get your mind onto somebody else's troubles, almost certainly. So what is the answer? That the individual has a life of his own, and that meditation is living continuously in the light of inward realization. It is not a smug, comfortable feeling, but it is a deep realization of value. It is a way of doing it that is better. It is a way of growing that becomes beautiful. and it is a growing that is natural. Just as the flowers of the village, of the valley and the garden grow because it is of their nature to grow. Man grows because growth is in him. It is his own nature. It is his own reason and purpose is to grow. No one tells him this. No one forces him to grow. No one tells him he should, really, in most cases. But growth is the fulfillment. It is the being that we are gradually coming through the shadows of our own mistakes. It is the wonder that was given to us in the beginning, but in the presence of which we can stand in awe. Yet with all its greatness and its awesomeness, it is still a very simple thing, a common, reasonable way of life. So if we can gradually get this type of thinking, we can also avoid most of the pitfalls that we face today when we do not know where to turn to find the answers to the questions that we want answers for. Instead of taking the idea that meditation is just going to get us to heaven in a very short time, or that any one of 100 different schools of it will get us there very promptly if we obey the rules, we must ask ourselves, what is this all about? Can any system take a poor person who is selfish and self-centered and irritable? Can any system lift that individual by his own bootstraps? Is it possible for the person to take with him into the celestial regions all the unfinished business he has here? He is here to grow. If he doesn't grow, what are his rewards beyond? Why should he say, I can make all the mistakes I want to here and enjoy blessedness somewhere else by a trick of the mind? He can't. He has to grow. And the mind is one of the wonderful instruments which will help him to grow. But he's going to have to be true to it if he expects it to be true to him. If he wants the mind to do things to help him to grow, he must never set it tasks that are unreal or unreasonable or unworthy of it. It is not, it sounds perhaps a little more difficult than it really is, because actually most people want to be happy. Very few people enjoy pain, whether it's physical, emotional, or mental. Very few people want to be in constant conflict with their world or their neighbors or their families. They would rather have a peaceful life. But in order to give up, or rather to gain this peaceful life, they have to give up some pet perversities of their own natures. In order to get this wonderful freedom that they need and want, and happiness, they've got to stop making mistakes that destroy the possibility of it. If we realize that, we find our destiny is in our own hands at all times. We can always be what we should be if we will be serious about it. Then, of course, in this type of thing, the seriousness of it gets to be a problem sometimes. People work so desperately hard on trying to be good that sometimes it's almost wish they would be bad instead and everyone would be happier. But actually, there's no need for this tremendous labor. There is no need for the individual to live constantly by frustration to knock out of his life the things he doesn't want to let go of, simply in the term of being spiritual. So let's say, for instance, that to the mystic, the philosopher, the idealist, the religionist, in the truest sense of the word, goodness is finally normal thing. Goodness is the way it ought to be. Goodness is keeping truth and keeping trust and keeping faith with a plan which in all its parts is sublime. And good, being good, means to be essentially God inhabited, God possessed. For good, the word good comes from God. Also, it means that in being good, we are simply keeping the rules. And by keeping the rules, we will lengthen life. We will get over the danger of many ailments of the flesh. We will have more friends, better families, better children. And in the long run, we'll look back from the point of years with a great realization of achievement. Then when those years of retirement come, and the individual gives up a busy life, he is already a completely busy being inside of himself. Then he can settle back and contemplate more upon the wonders that have been meaningful to him. He can improve his knowledge and his insight. He can go further and further into the unfoldment of elements of his character which need special attention. And he can enjoy it. Becoming a better person is a great hobby if you can only get used to it. It does more for us than any way that we can possibly plan a vacation. It is all finally to do the thing that needs doing and be glad when you see the wonderful consequences of doing it well. So we take a meditation is really a continuous obedience to the best of ourselves. It is the constant awareness that we are significant, that we are not so simply born to fail or born to suffer. We are here and are part of a great plan of victory, of success, of inevitable fulfillment. And with that type of thinking, we will naturally begin to change our attitudes. I've noticed in working with people who get into serious psychoneurotic situations that nearly all of them have bad backgrounds in relationship to life. One case that I know, a young woman back in the days of our parents who fell in love with a personable young man, and the parents refused to sanction the marriage because she had an older sister, and according to the rules, the older sister had to marry first. Now, this was a frustration. The young woman had a broken heart, really. She probably really was sincerely in love. And unfortunately for her, the older sister didn't get married very soon. So the whole situation fell apart. 50 years later, this same attitude was besetting this woman. She could never forget it. She could never do anything but say that her parents ruined her life. Well, on the level of the occurrence, that is true. But there must be some way within ourselves to compensate for these hurts if we really want to. She could outgrow it and could probably have found someone and had a very good life had she not settled down to being sorry for herself for half a century. This doesn't help. Nature doesn't expect us to do that. But as a result of this continued situation, her whole life was miserable. She was never able to be glad that maybe that her sister did get married first. I don't know all the details. But anyway, she could rise above it if she had wanted to. Now you can see that a girl of that age might not be able to rise above a serious hurt. It could be done if the family itself had given her strong religious insights, or if as she went along through life, she developed religious realizations, or found good outlets for constructive attitudes, but nothing happened. She was locked. Now anyone who does this, or just goes through this type of situation, is a victim of his own mind. We are all victims of the mind. The only way that we can get over this is to make the mind an asset rather than a liability. We can gradually learn to know that the mind is a magnificent instrument. We should be grateful for it, but we must use it wisely. The poor workman always complains of his tools, and nearly everyone who is making mistakes blames his own mind or somebody else's mind for his troubles. The truth of the matter is the mind has to be educated in a very definite way, not by necessarily the reading, writing, and arithmetic technique, but by quietly recognizing the responsibilities and purposes of life. The mind must have a dedication. It must live in us for the purpose of fulfilling the divine plan that is locked within ourselves. We are here to use the mind to advance our destiny. To deny the mind is no use. To say that it's always a fallacy is not true. Deity never presents a fallacy as a part of a structure in life. It is the use we've made of it that has made it a dangerous instrument. It is an abuse of a power. The only way we can correct that power is to correct its function. We should not try to get rid of it. What we should try to do is build upon it the fulfillment of the purpose for which it was created. The mind is there to help us to grow. We will be poorer if we don't use it, but we will be very poor if we abuse it. So this meditation is really a kind of mental normalcy. It is binding the mind itself to the convictions of the inner life. Just as the old mystic perhaps went into the monastery and gave his life to services of the poor, so the mind has to make its dedication. It must be assisted and stimulated to dedicate itself to the proper service of the body which it inhabits, and help to lead the being in the body toward the eternal truth for which it was intended. The mind is a very valuable thing, and any system which perverts it or corrupts it or ties it to something less than itself is going to be ultimately a disappointment and a tragedy. The mind must never be coerced. It must be led quietly along ways of constructive living. Common sense is the beginning of this learning, and by daily and in normal patterns, being just a little more thoughtful every day, a little more conscientious, and a little more dedicated, we will find the mind in the long run will bring us home in glory, and we'll be very happy about the whole thing. In the meantime, I think we better close for the morning. Thank you very much.